Shammy chose to scuttle his peace diplomacy. He sidestepped a challenge to his leadership by embracing four conditions laid down by hardline industry and trade minister Ariel Sharon and his allies and plainly designed to be unacceptable to the Palestinians. Most indigestible was a restriction barring the 140,000 Arab residents of East Jerusalem from participating in the proposed elections. Shamir also agreed that Israel would not return any of the occupied territories to foreign sovereignty, that the construction of Jewish settlements in the West Bank and Gaza would continue, and that the proposed elections could not take place until the 19-month-old Intifada ended. Ironically, Shammy has espoused these same positions many times. But he had hoped to keep them in the background, while he maneuvered to keep on top of the pressures for peace, emphasis supplied. In addition to Ababan, other Israelis are finally beginning to recognize that the Likud has been deluding them all along about its desire for peace. In an article in the Jerusalem Post of October 28, 1989, entitled Moment of Truth, David Landor, a member of the editorial staff of the Post, complains that Shamir is still wrapping his true intent in its issue of disingenuousness. The words peace, Camp David and Two-Face Solution studied his policy statements, but they do not mean what they say. Landor writes, thus, when Shamir asserted to the Jerusalem Post last week that he is confident the Palestinians of Judea, Samaria and Gaza will eventually ditch the PLO and talk to Israel on Israel's terms, he didn't mean it. He isn't confident. What he means is that as far as he is concerned, the present situation can continue indefinitely. Intifada? Isolation? Brutalization? Prolonged stalemate and eventual threat of war? If these are the price for attaining Judea, Samaria and Gaza, then they are an acceptable price. But he does not say that either. Rather, he speaks of the government's peace initiative pretending that he has not just emptied that term of any vestige of meaning. He speaks of Camp David ignoring his own and Foreign Minister Ahrens's opposition to that agreement. He speaks of his commitment to the two-phase solution, concealing his determination that the first phase, carefully circumscribed autonomy for the Palestinians, remain in force indefinitely, unless the Arabs accept the Likud's ideas for a permanent settlement. He formally disqualified the PLO because it was terrorist and committed to Israel's destruction. Now, having, at least formally, renounced those two characteristics, the organization is still disqualified. In the Premier's words, because we oppose a Palestinian state in Eretz Yisrael, we cannot negotiate with the PLO. But since Shamir opposes any withdrawal from the territories, he cannot in truth negotiate with anyone because he has nothing to negotiate about. But that truth is unpalatable, Shammy therefore obfuscates it with words and concepts castrated of their original meaning, emphasis supplied. This, of course, is Bajin speak at its finest. It may be news, and also disillusioning, to the Jerusalem Post, but it's been going on non-stop for 13 years. But why should anyone be surprised that demagogues like Shamir and Sharon do not want peace? If peace broke out, what would become of them? What are the job opportunities for someone with Shamir's experience? What can a hero like General Sharon look forward to as a finish to his illustrious career? As of now, Sharon is riding on top of the world promoting his book, the title of which is Not Shalom But Warrior. He appears on American television talk shows as a celebrity. He is being wined and dined everywhere. If peace comes, who would buy his book or even buy his lunch? Sharon and his final solution, regardless of which Likud leader holds power, Israel's dilemma remains unchanged, and she will continue as she is, bleeding to death. However, if Sharon's ambition to become prime minister is achieved, a new and far more ominous development is in prospect. The question then arises, how would Sharon solve Israel's dilemma, and why does Sharon appear so confident that he has a solution? The answer may be that he does. His solution has nothing to do with peace, other than avoiding it at all costs. From Sharon's standpoint, it has everything going for it, and made to order for a would-be king of Israel. Sharon's power base consists of the following. 1. The religious nationalist extremists who are clamoring for a solution to Israel's dilemma by one great military strike to expel the Palestinians, Amalek, from the West Bank and Gaza using any means necessary, which will pave the way for the coming of the Messiah too. The Gush Emunim and other West Bank settlers who, for personal or religious reasons, are determined to get rid of the Palestinians. 3. Those in Israel who, regardless of religious conviction, believe that the Palestinians must be transferred, expelled, in order to preserve the Jewishness of the Jewish state. 4. Those Israelis who are not religious zealots, and who are not disposed to war for war's sake, but who are exhausted psychologically with Israel's continuing dilemma, and feel that some solution is better than no solution. They will follow a leader, even Sharon, if he promises an end to the debilitating internal strife which is destroying Israel. What is Sharon's solution? As discussed earlier, present Likud policy is designed and intended to bring about emigration from the West Bank and Gaza, by making life in the occupied territories intolerable for its Palestinian inhabitants. Some highly placed individuals in the Israeli military have considered accelerating this process, by shipping the Arabs to Jordan in lorries. However, this is obviously too slow a process, to solve problems which must be solved now. Sharon has boasted that he could put down the Intifada in 48 hours, if he was in charge of the Israeli army. But simply putting down the uprising still leaves the Palestinians in possession of their lands, and nothing is solved. On the other hand, even Sharon cannot simply load 1,500,000 or more Palestinians on trucks and dump them into Jordan. That process would also be too slow. Long before it could be carried to completion, the United Nations, with the support of the major powers, would no doubt intervene. This would be the worst of all possible worlds. All of Israel's present problems would be exacerbated, and the hostility of the world community would be raised to such a pitch that a peace might be imposed on Israel. However, these are risks that Sharon need not take. There is a safer and proven alternative. It can be summarized as follows. 1. Israel would continue to stall, delay and confuse any peace efforts, by using the same tried and true methods which the Likud has successfully employed for the past 13 years too. It will not be long before the peacemakers are thoroughly discouraged, and have given up in frustration. 3. It will be at this point that Arafat's probationary period will be at an end, and the extremists in the PLO will say, "We told you so," and will take over a newly radicalized PLO. 4. The Intifada will escalate into real terrorism in the occupied territories, verging on guerrilla warfare. Everything will be done by Sharon to provoke the PLO into committing terrorist acts. 5. The West Bank settlers will demand that the government mobilize the Israeli army to stop these atrocities. 6. Sharon will then announce to the world that "I told you so, the PLO has always been nothing but a bunch of terrorists, and could never be trusted." 7. Sharon will declare an insurrection in the occupied territories, and mobilize the Israeli army to put down the revolt and restore order. The battle plan will be the same used in 1948 by the Haganah under Ben-Gurion, the Eigen terrorists under Begin, and the Lehi under Shammai. The elements of this war plan are set forth in detail in Chapter 4, taken from Israeli declassified military archives and the Ben-Gurion Diaries 8. The Israeli army, together with its West Bank settler vigilantes, will launch a surprise attack, and will sweep across the West Bank and Gaza. Hundreds of Palestinian villages will be destroyed, and homes and lands devastated. A few massacres, like Deir Yassin in 1948, will be carried out, to make sure the Palestinians get the message of what will happen to them if they don't leave. Slowly at first, and then in a tidal wave of humanity, more than 1,500,000 terrified Palestinian men, women, and children will stream in a panic across the border into Jordan. This efficient plan for expelling the Palestinians presents no serious problem to the Israeli army. In 1948, a much smaller Israeli army, far less well-equipped than the present one, by using these same tactics successfully drove 700,000